This is Charles Zeltzer speaking February 6th, 2015, and the title is The Wisdom of the Body in Kundalini, Alchemy, and Individuation. There were a few slides in this presentation. It was recorded on DVD, and this DVD is available in the library at the Seattle Jung Society.
He's been doing animals for the past 22 years. He is a former director of analyst training at the C.G. Jung Institute of Los Angeles. He was a member of the editorial board of the Jungian Journal, Psychological Perspectives, and guest-edited special volumes of that journal. In addition to his private practice in Santa Monica and Ventura, California, he has spoken frequently in Europe and throughout the United States on the intersection of religion and psychology, alchemy as a religious endeavor, and the relationship between the body, psyche, and trauma. Charles is currently in the process of completing his first book with the working title of Awakening the Depths, Where Kundalini, Alchemy, and Individuation Meet. Sounds pretty deep. He is simultaneously working on a self-autobiography entitled Between the Skin and the Flesh. And Charles says the following thing about his own journey. I was born into some kind of minimal intermediate space between my parental opposites of strict Roman Catholicism and Orthodox Judaism. Reading the Bhagavad Gita at the age of 14 led me to read Catholic devotion. Being introduced to Greek mythology at age 15 and the study of Freud at age 17 furthered my serendipitous inner journey until the age of 21 when I found Jewish mysticism and Jung. Since then, Jung's approach has been the guiding compass of my professional work and my inner work. In addition, these other interests, Hindu and Tantric philosophy, mythology, Jewish mysticism, and alchemy, have evolved and developed, interweaving themselves with the depths that Jung has opened to me. The thread behind all of it is a passionate love of the psyche. Charles Elson.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here. I noticed I was expecting rain all weekend, and I got here and the sky opened up. So I'm thinking maybe I brought a little sun to you, and I'm hoping I take a little of your rain back with me. We desperately need it in California. It is a meaty subject, and this is my meat. I'm not going to read this to you. I wouldn't dare. But I'll tell you, it's been kind of a struggle to prepare for this because to try to condense my manuscript into 2 hours, it's hard to know where to cut and snip. And so I think I'm going to ignore it completely. And we'll just see what happens. I had a dream that said to me I should talk about the animals. So I think what I'm going to do, I'll mention every animal that's connected to every chakra. We'll go through my slides. So we're going to have a little bit of a slideshow. And we'll see what comes up for me. And hopefully you'll get a sense of this. Now, I have been interested in Hinduism since I was 14 years old, as was mentioned. And I think the thing about Hinduism that just struck such a chord was the imagery, and that they seem to have a psychological attitude about their imagery, and it kind of broke that participacion mystique that I was in with Catholicism. So there are so many different gods and goddesses in Hinduism, and to me what that means is that there are so many different ways of looking at things. There are many different psychologies, different psychological perspectives. You know, Jung once said that if you walk down a street in Manhattan and you look around, you'll see people who have the psychology of someone from the Stone Age, someone from the time of ancient Greece, someone from the Middle Ages, someone from the modern era, and one or two people that are ahead of their time. You know, in a way, I think the chakras tell us that, show us that same thing. You know, the word chakra means wheel. And each chakra is a wheel or a world completely unto itself. It's a total way of thinking about things, which has its own set of values, its own morality about it. If you meet someone whose psyche, whose consciousness is located in a different chakra than yours is, you won't understand each other at all. Now, I want to say that a couple of people came up to me already today and said, oh, I'm so excited you're going to talk about the Kundalini. And actually, I'm not going to speak too much about the Kundalini energy, because what I'm really talking about is the psychology of the chakras. And why am I talking about that? Because that psychology of the chakras that depicts the movement from the first chakra up through the seventh is very similar to what Jung is talking about when he speaks about the process of individuation. And that's what he began to look at in his 1932 Kundalini seminars. It's also similar to what we see when we look at the alchemical process. In fact, Kundalini yoga, which comes out of tantric philosophy, is Hindu alchemy. It was considered to be alchemy. Why is that? Because it is the transformation of something connected with base matter into spirit. So it's the movement from gross matter into subtle matter. That's the same thing as in alchemy. In alchemy, we say that there is a spirit hidden in matter. There's the divine is in matter. And the whole goal of alchemy really is to extract that spirit out of matter. And the interesting thing about Kundalini is the object of that extraction is the human body, the human being. That there is a spirit in our basest matter which lies hidden and has to be extracted and raised up. Now, we see the same thing actually if you look at the Sephirotic tree in the Kabbalah. The lower end of the Sephirotic tree rests in the world, and the upper end is the Ein Sof, or the divine being, which is indescribable. It's amazing to me when I started studying Kundalini how similar those stories were. It was shocking. It really makes me think that at some point in time there had to be some kind of cross-fertilization between Hindu, the Kundalini tantric philosophy, and the Gnostic Kabbalistic philosophy. So let me just start with the myth that lies behind the chakras. It goes something like this. In the beginning, there was a being named Shiva. Shiva was Shiva is just isness. Shiva is. But Shiva existed without consciousness of himself. Then, for some unknown, mysterious reason, it's never said why in the story, Shiva had a desire. Now, in the Kabbalistic story, they talk about that a little bit. The god, the Ein Sof, of the Kabbalah actually did something called a retraction, which made an empty space. And once this empty space was there, he had a desire. He is used very much in quotes. So Shiva had a desire, and this desire took the form of Shakti, or divine feminine energy. Once this energy came into existence, it began to move, and it moved downward from the uppermost territory of the seventh chakra, and as it moved down, it created. She created. She took the form of a serpent, the Kundalini serpent, and in every level, a certain territory or aspect of existence was created until Shakti came down to the first level, the first chakra, where she rested, wrapped 2.5 times around the lingam or phallus of Shiva with the serpent's mouth over the head of the phallus, holding it down so it could not move up. And there she fell asleep. And that is the predicament that we find ourselves in when we enter the world asleep. So here is our yogi, and you see here the seven chakras. I think you have your little sheets that I gave you. So we have the first chakra here in the perineum, and that is the Muladhara chakra. And then we have, in the second chakra is called Svadhisthana, and that is in the bladder. There we are. Then we have Manipura, which is in the solar plexus, the belly area. And then we have Anahata, which is the chakra of the heart and the lungs. Where's my little cursor? There we go. Visuddha, the chakra of the throat. Here we have Ajna, the third eye. And the seventh chakra, sometimes it's not really called a chakra. It really sits about 2 inches above the crown of the head. And that is called Sahasrara, Sahasrara. What we see here is the central channel that runs up the spine. You see that line in the center. That's called the Sushumna channel. And then we have 2 side channels that intersect, and those are called the Ida and the Pingala channel, the channel of the moon and the channel of the sun. This is the Hindu version of the Tao, the yin and the yang. Here we see a 12th century image of the Ida and Pingala channels. They are also serpents, the sun serpent and the moon serpent. And the light area in here is called the invisible lingam of Shiva. This image of the intertwined serpents, or the serpent wrapped around some kind of channel or pole, is one of the most fundamental archetypal images we know of. Here we have the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve are our version of the Ida and the Pingala. This serpent... In the Bible, it's considered to be evil. In the Kabbalah, it's not considered to be evil. It's considered to be an image of wisdom, and it guards the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, or the knowledge or consciousness, the tree of consciousness. This is not so far from the serpent that wraps itself around the channel through which we achieve consciousness. Here we have William Blake. This is his version of the story of Moses and the fiery serpents. You see the people in the background being bitten by serpents. And Moses stands before this great serpent, which in the story is cast in bronze. In other words, it's made of fire. And the story goes that the Israelites were in the desert. They had just been handed a great victory over their enemies by the Lord, at which point they complained about how sick they were of their food and having to wander around in the desert. And Yahweh became enraged with them and sent fiery serpents to bite them. Then Moses pleaded with Yahweh and said, please take this curse off away from us. And Yahweh said, cast a brazen serpent on a pole, and whoever gazes upon it will be freed of the affliction. So this idea of pinning the serpent on the pole then moved into Christian mythology, Christian iconography, with the idea that Christ became the serpent that was fixed on the pole. And then later I'll show you an alchemical image of a serpent nailed to a cross. All of these are images of what the alchemists call fixing the volatile. Okay. We'll see later how important this image is when we get to the third chakra. So here we have the first chakra. It is called Muladhara, which means root support. And it really is at the root, the base of the spine, or the base of the torso. And it has four lotus petals. Now, each lotus petal, as we go up the chakras, you'll see that each lotus petal has a letter of the alphabet on it. For the Hindus, as you move up the chakras, the other thing you see developing is the Hindu alphabet. So there's a whole story about that, which I don't really have any time to go into, about why each letter of the alphabet is at this chakra and others at another chakra. But we see here that the chakras also illustrate the unfolding of speech and therefore the unfolding of thought. As we move up the chakras, the number of petals on the lotus will increase. So we have a number of petals. We have an animal. We have a color. Here the animal is the elephant. We have a color. We have a bodily location. Here it's the perineum. And we also have a female deity which governs tells us something about the psychology of this particular chakra, and a male deity, which tells us about the psychology of the chakra. Now, and we have an element and a sense. So since this is the lowest chakra, of course the element will be earth. And it's down there in the perineum where all our earthy functions are, and this color is a very muddy crimson, so it has kind of an earthy quality to it. And then, of course, we have the elephant, and this elephant has seven trunks, because the elephant, when it... makes the noise with its trunks. It kind of is the audio awakening. Okay, and so we say that the elephant kind of toots its trunk at each chakra. So there's a trunk for each chakra. Now, this elephant, if you'll see, it has a little black right here. That's a collar because this elephant is not free. The elephant will return in the fifth chakra, but it's a very different elephant with a different quality. The elephant of this Muladhara chakra is the elephant connected to the earth, connected to matter. And it's connected, the elephant is the beast of burden in India. The word Aleph actually comes from the Hebrew alphabet. It's the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and it means ox. So it's the Indian ox. And those of you who know the ox herding pictures of Zen Buddhism, there is a parallel here in the development of the chakras and the development of the ox herding pictures. So this elephant, it carries heavy loads. It supports the most material stuff. If I were to think of what the elephant or the ox in modern America is, I think it would be the pickup truck. So what do we experience psychologically at this chakra? This is the chakra of collectivity. This is the chakra of collective institutions like governments, the church, religious organizations, anything that has a collective consciousness about it. A culture has a certain collective consciousness. And when we're born, the first thing we learn about is not our individuality. We learn about the general rules of how to conduct ourselves. This is the first chakra. Now you see also here, in this downward pointing triangle, which is an image of the feminine deity, the yoni, it's an image of the feminine genitals. And within it, you see the lingam of Shiva. And here in white is the Kundalini serpent wrapped around it with her head over the top, forcing it down, keeping it asleep. So when we're in this chakra, we're essentially asleep. We follow collective ideas. We follow collective norms. Our morality is the morality of the collective. And we don't get out of that too much. Here we have the male deity of the first chakra, and he is called Brahma. Now, this is different when you get into Hindu mythology, that it's different than Brahman, the creator god. Some of the names in the chakra of the chakra gods are similar, but they don't have the same meaning as in Vedic mythology. Now, these gods and goddesses are all aspects of the ultimate divinity, Shiva, but they represent the aspect that we have to become aware of and get connected to at this particular level of psychological development. So this is the child, because this is really the psychology of the child. And this chakra, by the way, would include a lot of modern psychologies. For example, most of Freudian psychology would be the territory of the first chakra. A lot of object relations work, Kleinian work, we can look at as first chakra material. In the second chakra, we'll move more into the phallic stage of Freud. Freud's oral and anal stages are more in this chakra. And the third chakra will have the psychology of Alfred Adler. That's much more predominant there. So he has five heads, this god, and this refers to the five senses, or ways of perceiving the world we live in. He has four hands. In the lower right hand, it forms a mudra, or hand gesture. That means fear not. The lower left hand is holding a libation jar, which is a community symbol of containment and prayer. The upper right hand holds mula beads, which are used in meditation practice. The first thing you learn in Hinduism is to pray. The first thing you learn in Hinduism as a child is to read, and what you learn to read are the scriptures. Those are your early books of reading. And then we also have the trident in the upper left hand. And originally, the trident was the tool of the mother goddess. And it has to do with sovereignty and with creative power that comes into being. So here in the iconology of the child, we have the unconscious nature and the community nature of the Muladhara chakra shown to us. Here we have the goddess of the first chakra. And her name is Dakini. She is the first chakra expression of Shakti. Now, the one thing about these pictures and most pictures that you see where the chakras are depicted is, unfortunately, the gods and the goddesses are not depicted as ferociously as they should look. Particularly in the lower chakras, the goddesses are very ferocious. And you get a little hint of that because here she is holding weapons and a skull. Why are they ferocious? Because the further you are away from a consciousness of the true reality, okay, the scarier that true reality is for you. So she holds here, we would say that what she expresses is the need to suffer and the need for sacrifice. Now, if I were to depict her, I think she should look a little bit more like this. That's what the goddess should look like that you're facing in the first chakra. It's a beautiful picture, actually, isn't it? I won't hold on to that too long. Go back to her. She holds a sacrificial spear because the bond with the mother must be sacrificed in order to move beyond this stage. The skull staff reminds us that life is transitory. The drinking cup refers to ritual, an important part of Muladhara life. And the sword is called the instrument of physical extermination with which she cuts the the threads of bondage or attachment via knowledge and wisdom. I'll read that again. The sword is the instrument of physical extermination with which she cuts the thread of bondage or attachment via knowledge and wisdom. So the path of consciousness is a bloody path. The alchemists would say it's a path of mortificatio and a path of separatio, okay? Of separating attachments, separating our consciousness from the collective. I once had a woman come to see me, and she had a horrific animus possession, terribly, her tongue was a sword. I remember what she said to me in the first session. She said, "You better be careful what you say to me, because if I don't like it, I'll rip you a new asshole." This was the first session. So her first dream was that she was walking out of a building at night, and she went into a cab. She went into the back of the cab, and there was a man in the dark in the back of the cab who, once she got in, began to stab her and rape her. Okay. What this shows is that she was not on good terms with the unconscious. She was not on good terms with the psyche. You know, Jung says, the face you show the unconscious is the face it shows you. So that man actually reflected her attitude toward the unconscious. After a lot of bloody work, a few years later, she had a dream that she was in her house and she heard a knock on the door, and she went to answer the door, and there was a man standing there, an unknown man, with a plant, and he handed her a plant. So you see the difference there. She did a lot of hard work, and we wrestled a lot, but you know, God bless her, because she stayed in it with me. And we did a lot of wrestling, and we got this guy settled down, and her attitude about her own psyche, of course, less out of the ego, right? And more acknowledging of the power of the unconscious, and humbling that ego position a bit. So then the relationship changed, and of course it's reflected completely in the dream. And we'll see this as we go up. The pictures will get a little more bloody of the feminine energy, and then they'll begin to soften. Are any of you familiar with this picture? Yes, but where does it come from? It's from a study in the process of individuation in Jung's volume, Archetypes in the Collective Unconscious. It's a beautiful story. I really recommend you read it and look at the images. They're the paintings of Christine Mann. Many of them, I think, are in the San Francisco Jung Library. And this is the initial painting. And I think that this painting has a lot of similarity to the Muladhara Chakra, because here we see a woman in amidst these stones, and her body really is stone, isn't it? It comes right out of that stone. She is looking into a black light. Everything is very dark. Her psychological condition at the time was depression. Things were held down, rock solid, no movement. But in the background, you have tumultuous waters. Interestingly enough, in the core of some of these stones, you see light. seeds of light buried in the stone, just like the sleeping lingam in the first chakra. The next image from this series. The flash of lightning, which separates one particular stone out from the rest. And you see, interestingly enough, that seed of light in the center, it's also heating up, isn't it? There's this redness around it. So, this is such a beautiful picture of the beginning of the individuation process. And interestingly, too, is the sea now is calm. And the energy is in this lightning. That flash of lightning is similar to what the Hindus describe with the Kundalini awakening in the first chakra. It comes as a jolt, as a sudden jolt, physiologically. And they say that when you awaken, that when that first awakening happens, that first ignition of the Kundalini energy, you hear the buzzing of the bees. And what it is the bees are buzzing because they sense the nectar in the seventh chakra. And sometimes you hear a sound that is like the buzzing of the bees. Are you familiar at all with this image? I think by now it's become a fairly common alchemical image. It's from the Mutus Liber, the book without words. It's the very first image. And we're going to be going through a lot of the Mutus Liber images because I found an uncanny connection between that process that's described by the Mutus Liber and the process of the development that we see in the chakras. Here we have, there we go. Here we have the alchemist asleep. He's sleeping on a stone, kind of like the lingam. Does this remind you of any biblical story? Jacob dreaming. He leaves his family. He gets the birthright by conniving with his mother. And then, so he's got this really interesting mother-son bond. He gets the birthright. His older brother's infuriated with him. He has to cross the river and leave the family. And the first night, he sleeps with his head on a rock. And he dreams of a ladder with angels going up and down, with horns, blowing horns. So I think the connection is obvious, isn't it? The ladder is very much like the Sushumna channel, and the angels themselves are like the energy itself, which blows an audial awakening. In the background, you can't see it too well in this picture, but right back here, there's all of these stone formations here, but right back here is the ocean or the sea, and the waters are just beginning to flow over the embankment there and come in. So you see, again, the hint of the activated waters of the second chakra. Interestingly here, too, there we go. We have these two branches of the rose, one facing down and one facing out. Again, these complementary opposites that intertwine, just like the Ida and Pingala channels intertwine as they go up through the chakras. Well, here we have the image of the second chakra. It's called Svadhisthana, which means proper place or her favorite abode. We're that close already? Oh, my goodness. Well, let me just say a few things about her, or this chakra, her favorite abode, which is the genital area. That animal there is called the Makara. If you've ever been to the Bodleian Library in Oxford, they have a beautiful sculpture of the Makara, which is an animal which has the trunk of an elephant, and the rest of it is very much like a crocodile and the tail of a fish. It's just above the bladder. We still have red, but it's a slightly lighter red. We have six petals. And this is the chakra of adolescence. I think one of the great stories of that would describe this chakra would be Rebel Without a Cause. Do you remember that film with James Dean? You know, what is adolescence about? It's about anything that's not about your parents, anything that's not about the collective. It's really the age, the era of breaking away. And here we have Vishnu, the male god of this chakra, who is an adolescent in this portrayal of Vishnu. Here we have the goddess energy, Shakti Rakini. And she's a little bloodier in that you see the fangs, and her red cheeks are red because the animal of sacrifice, she's rubbed the blood on her cheeks. And if it were a true depiction, there would be blood dripping from her mouth. Okay. So again, she's meant to frighten us, but she also here, the battle axe, by the way, is to chop off your head. Because if you don't get your head chopped off, you'll never get to your heart and the rest of your body. And particularly with Westerners, we definitely need our heads chopped off. As Jung said, the difference between the Westerner and the Easterner is that the Westerner is stuck up here, not with consciousness, unconsciously stuck up here. So his journey, his or her journey, is to go from the head down. We have to get down to the first chakra and then move up through all of the chakras, whereas the Hindu, they can start down at the bottom. So, you know, why the interest in the body so much today? Because it's a recognition that we have to move our consciousness down into those lower chakras first before we can have a true wisdom. I just threw that in there because I like it. This is the goddess Chinamnastra, who is an aspect of Kali. Kali is an amazing goddess. She gets a bad rap. Kali is the goddess of nature. She's not just the goddess of destruction. She's the goddess of creation, too. And creation only happens with destruction. Creation occurs on the fundament underneath creation is destruction. So here we have the goddess Chinamnastra. She has cut off her own head. And the blood is spurting out her neck. And her two devotees are lapping the blood up with their tongues. And so is her own head lapping the blood up. And she stands over the two corpses of the male and female in intercourse. Very bloody, graphic stuff, but this is a profound image of the cycle of creation and destruction. The solar splendus. I slay thee that thou may have life. Same concept as Kali. Kali is often depicted with black, disheveled hair. Here we have a wild man with black, disheveled hair. And he's cut this man up, and he holds the golden head. Again, mortificatio, separation, all very important for the attainment of consciousness. I have to detach and observe. But it's a funny kind of detachment. Jung talks about this detachment, I think, very beautifully. He says the ultimate goal is that we stand with our lower self rooted in the chakras, but our head above it observing. So it's this paradox of observing and experiencing at the same time. Another way he says it is we have one foot in the experience and one experiencing it, feeling it, and another foot outside of it, observing it at the same time. When you move through a chakra, you don't leave it. You open it. It's called piercing the knot. So the knot opens up. So I am eternally in the Muladhara chakra. I am eternally in the Svadhisthana chakra. They've opened up. It doesn't mean I'm identified with that way of thinking anymore, but I still have my rootedness in that part of the body and that kind of experience. Oops, I went backwards. Here we have the second picture of the mutus liber, and this again, the action hasn't started yet. The fire is not lit. The adept and soror, the alchemist and his chemical sister, kneel in prayer. The waters are above. And notice who it is who can touch the archetypal realm. It's the feminine that touches the heavenly realm above. We begin here in the Mutus Liber with some pictures that involve the number two. The adept and the soror, the two angels, the sun and the moon sitting on each side of Poseidon. And here we have, I like to say, this is almost like looking through a periscope or a telescope or something. And what we have here is an image of the multiple layers of the psyche. And what's interesting is there's lines that connect someone in one layer to the next layer. So here we have the adept with a fishing pole, and here we have the soror with her hand here. Up here we have another two lines going from the boat down here. If you look closely, this is all over the place. And what it's beginning to say to you is that, life is not one-dimensional. It's not all as you see it. There's something other than what I see. So we're connecting to the different layers. And then we have this next picture. And this is the adept and the soror twisting the sheets. The sheets are put out in the field to collect the dew. The dew is the prima materia, sometimes called the spendings from the divine lovemaking up in the sky that drops down on the earth. In the medieval world, they had a wonderful imagination. It's too bad we've lost that, But the next time you see the dew, think about that. So they twist it with an opposite motion, and the dew comes out and goes into a vat, and that is the prima materia, which is the object of the alchemical opus. One of the things I think that is different between Kundalini and our Western approach is what ignites our development in the West is our wounds. In Kundalini, they don't really talk about it that way. You practice yoga and you move through these things, but there's not an emphasis so much on woundedness. But what brings us into the analytic container? It's our woundedness. So that's what propels us on our journey. I think we should take a break. Let's make it 10 minutes. I've got a lot more to tell you. I have to condense it, but we'll do our best. Thank you. You know, we've had this image of the sword going through a lot of them and a lot of the images so far, the gods and goddesses. So while we're coming back in, I just wanted to read you something to show you the universality of these images. This comes from Matthew chapter 10. Do not think that I have come to bring peace on earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's foes will be those of his own household. Now, when you go to church, you don't hear that one very much. But that is a classic statement for the movement out of the first chakra. And it shows it as a religious endeavor. I have not come to bring peace but a sword. That's a different God image than what normally comes up in Christianity. Somehow I have to get through these. I don't know how I'm going to do this. So here we have the third chakra. I've written an article in 2002, I published an article called The Role of the Third Chakra in the Psychology of Terrorism. The second chakra, the element is water. The third chakra, the element is fire. What you notice going on is that as we move up the chakras, the density of the matter, it gets less and less dense. It gets more and more volatile. Once we have broken out of that kind of heavy being held down by the collective, and then we get that surge of energy in the adolescent territory and the sexual territory, then we get into the full experience of our own energy and power in the third chakra. It's the ego has developed to its fullest in the third chakra, and we experience ourselves as being very, very powerful. Now, that's fine. You know, we all need, it's necessary to have an experience of power. It's necessary to have an experience of being overpowered. It's necessary to have an experience of overpowering someone. And it's necessary to have an experience of letting go of that power, of disidentifying from it. We can't really get through the third chakra unless we've sinned. I'm not telling you to go out and sin. You'll do that without my recommendation anyway, and you already have. So it's a matter of how do we integrate it. This chakra is the chakra, at its worst, it's the chakra of identification with power. I remember in the early 2000s, I think it was around 2002, there was this man in D.C. He had a younger man as an accomplice, and he was a sniper. Remember, he was shooting people at gas stations. And he gave a message to the police on the tarot card of death, the hangman. And he wrote on it, "I am God." That is the psychology of the third chakra. What you see ISIS doing is the psychology of the third chakra. what you see Boko Haram doing in Africa is the psychology of the third chakra. And we have plenty of it in our country. We don't have to go beyond our borders and point the finger out there. It's all over the place here. You know, abuse, physical, sexual abuse, passive aggression is a very powerful identification with the third chakra. And identifying yourself as a victim is also an identification with the flip side of the coin of the third chakra. Briefly, the god of the third chakra is an old man, Vishnu, somewhat like Yahweh. Powerful affects, identified with his affects. He sits on a bull because the bull is the animal of sacrifice. And what we have to do, and one of the hardest things we will ever have to do in our lifetime, is to learn how to sacrifice our connection to power, our identification with power, or our identification with the victim. He sits on the bull, but the main animal of the third chakra is the ram, which is also the sacrificial animal. You see, he has fire in his hand because fire has to do also with sacrifice. It is rage, it is intensity of affect, but in order to get out of beyond this chakra, I don't want to say out of, but through it, we have to learn to turn that fire on our own fire. He has the mudra, fear not, and the other one, encouraging the soul. It's like, move along, don't be afraid of all the terrible things you're going to experience and see, because behind it is the divine. Here's the goddess of the third chakra, Lakini or Lakshmi. She again sits on a lotus, and she has the fangs and the blood coming out of her mouth. I put this image here of the mercurial serpent nailed to the cross because this is truly the image of the fixing of the volatile, and this is the place where we have to fix the volatile, where whatever in us, whether it's whatever the intensity is that's got a hold of us, whether it's rage, whether it's compulsive and impulsive sexuality, whether it's an addiction that we can't stop, whatever it is, we have to fix that volatile thing. We have to have a prohibition against acting out. Jung says, if you put your devil in a bottle, you'll give it a hard time. And if you give it a hard time, you'll have a hard time. It's really one of the most difficult things that one can do. Is because, you know, when you're caught in that moment of intense affectivity, there's a little thing that goes on in you that says, well, I have the right to feel this way. And somehow you have to develop a consciousness that can get out of that enough to say, I know you feel you have the right, but you don't, and I won't let you. It's a struggle. And the fact of the matter is you can't do it alone. It only comes when you realize that there's something other than the ego, when there's something more than just the ego. And that's what happens in the fourth chakra. And I'm sorry I have to skip a few pictures here. And here we have this beautiful image of the fourth chakra. Again, you see an increasing number of petals of the lotus. We have the Star of David, which is also called the Grand Yoni. It's the conjunction of the upward and downward moving triangle in the center of the grand yoni is another yoni, and in the center of that is the lingam of Shiva. It's often called the Christ child that is born in the heart. The animal of this chakra is the antelope, because it's the first, in this chakra, we have the first experience of the divine, the first experience of the other. And the divine comes like an antelope, quick as a breath, flits across the screen of our eyes. Just a glimpse. Anahata, the name of this, is means unhit or unstruck. Reminds me of the Zen koan, what is the sound of one hand clapping? So we're beginning to get into things that we cannot explain, that we cannot understand through normal logic. That's why the images are so important. You know, it makes more sense to say that the divine is like an antelope than to try to define the divine in this chakra. I have to say a wonderful little story about this. I had some dear friends who had a beautiful second home that they never used anymore. It was up in an area called the Santa Ynez Valley, north of Santa Barbara, on a beautiful ranch. And they said to me, Charles, just go up there and use it whenever you want. So I would go there to write. And one wall was all windows looking out on beautiful oak trees. And there were some grasses. And so the time I was going to write the material on the fourth chakra. And there's a little table by the window. I went over to the window, to the table. I sat down. I opened up my computer. And a beautiful deer came and laid down right in front of me on the other side of the glass. And when I was finished writing, 2 hours later, it got up and left. So I was visited by the antelope of the fourth chakra. This, to me, I feel, is the most important chakra. It is the culmination of the lower chakras, and it begins the movement to the rest. It's said of the Buddha that when he achieved enlightenment, he went up to the ninth chakra. Then he came down and revisited every chakra, went down to the first, went up again through the chakras to the ninth, and then for the rest of his life, he lived in the fourth chakra. This is the chakra of the thought of the heart. This is Isa, the god of the fourth chakra. A very softened, beautiful youth, not adolescent, youth. You see the beautiful bindu there in the third eye. Gentle, riding the antelope. And Sakti Kakini, still somewhat fierce, she's said to be gently clad. She rides the antelope, and she has the skin of the antelope on her because she now is becoming more civilized. She tells us to fear not and encourages us, but she has a noose in one hand and the skull in the other, because we have to exterminate our consciousness as we know it to move into the higher, more expanded consciousness. Again, I apologize for skipping over some of these images. I just can't do them all. This, unfortunately, is a little hard to see the center, but it is all white. This is the fifth chakra, and it's called the completely purified, or purgation. The location is here at the throat, and the color is smoky purple. The lotus leaves are, the lotus petals are smoky purple, and in the center is the white elephant, no longer with a collar around its neck. Why a white elephant? Because unlike the fourth chakra, here, psychic reality, spiritual reality, is a solid fact. Jung says that spiritual reality is the fact, and then there's a thin skin of earthly reality around it. So this is a completely different experience of the world. It's also the chakra of expression. When we think of the throat, we think of expressing ourselves. Because we have sacrificed our impulses in the third chakra, and we were enabled to do that by an awareness that there is something divine that is not me. The fires that burn all of that stuff that needs to be sacrificed, the smoke flows up into the fifth chakra, through the fourth and into the fifth. And that smoke, that smoky purple color, and that smoke from the sacrifice of our impulses becomes our creativity. So this is the chakra of creativity. I want to go back 1 second to this. This is a conjunctio chakra. We have the union of the downward moving triangle and the upward. It's the first chakra where the opposites begin to come together. It's the chakra where the Buddha stays in that chakra because he is completely aware of the divine, having been to the upper ones, but he is also fully in the body at the same time. So this is where we hold both the awareness of the greater psyche and an awareness and a beingness in our physical body at the same time. Here we have the male. Whoops, it's not showing up. Here we go. Here we have the male god, Sada Shiva of the fifth chakra. He is actually an androgen. The gold side is male, the white side is female. And he has all of these tools because as our consciousness develops, we have all of these psychological tools available to us. He sits on the purified bull, the bull that the sacrifice has occurred. So now this energy is all that he's funded by the bull energies. He sits on, that's what funds him. But there's this powerful energy now towards the psyche, towards psychological development. When we get up into these chakras where the reality of the psyche becomes more apparent to us, this is the territory where we begin to experience a lot of synchronicities. I was giving a talk a couple of weeks ago, and I was talking about a dream, and I said, this is a very interesting image of the unconscious. And as soon as I said the word the unconscious, I forgot to turn off my cell phone, and it rang, and I looked at it, and it said, unknown. I was talking with a woman in therapy once, and she brought in a dream of a black woman. And so we were talking, well, what is this image of the black woman? What does this mean to you? You know, and we talked about, you know, she was somebody so caught in her head, and she really wasn't in her body. And just as we were talking about this, I had the window to my office open, and outside this car drove past with the radio blasting, and it was Aretha Franklin singing, "What You Need, Baby, I Got It." So these are the things that happen when you become tuned into that world. You don't cause a synchronicity, but there's something about when the ego gets small enough to experience the greater reality, that the greater reality makes itself known to us. It reminds us in a myriad of ways, and synchronicity is just one of those ways. Here we have the beautiful Gauri. She's not so fierce anymore. But what funds her? What does she sit on? She sits on the skulls, and she still has these weapons. You know, the goad is up there, and the noose, and the bow, and the arrow. But she sits on the skulls because so much of the facing of our own death, so much of our own willingness to die has already occurred. You know, when you're willing, that's another great statement of Jesus, he who loses his life for my sake will gain it. It's the same idea. If you're willing to let go, then you really get life. That's the great message that she gives us. And so when you do that, she's very happy, and she becomes the beneficent goddess. That the bow and arrow I really love because on the one hand, she's also the goddess that really hits the bullseye. She'll nail you. Yeah. Here we have the Ajna Chakra, which means the place of command, and it's right here in the third eye. Pure white, the white is of the moon. The white is of the moon. There are only two petals to this lotus. We went through this multiplicity of petals in the last one, and now there are just two. It's called the winged seed. There's no animal anymore. And when we get to the sixth and seventh chakras, it's really difficult to talk about them because we're talking about the ineffable. And some of the things that I might say about this chakra, I'm going to say about the seventh too, because they're really beyond words. There is no sense organ, no element. The chakra is a lunar white, and the seeker has transcended the limitations of physical reality. It's harder to speak of the experience. Paradoxical statements are true and are accessible only by experience. It is the seat or the point of origin of all the mental faculties. A depth of understanding is achieved that is beyond words. The bodily location is the third eye, and the concept of inner sight, or the capacity for great insight, and the ability to see the essential psychic truth, exists here. Jung says, in the Vasuddha chakra, the prior one, physical reality was still opposed to psychical reality. Therefore, one still used the support of the white elephant to sustain the reality of the psyche. But in the ajna center, the psyche gets wings. And here you know you are nothing but psyche. At the ajna center, the ida and the pingala channels, the channels of the sun and moon, meet and flow into the sushumna channel, which then extends into the seventh chakra and beyond. So just above this center is where the sun and the moon meet. This is where psychological duality begins. You know, when we think of the creation story I told you about, it doesn't start in the first chakra, does it? It starts up here. And then Shakti moves down into the world. In her first movement out of that seventh chakra into the world, dualities start. And the first duality are the image of the sun and the moon. Those are images. So that's where inner opposition begins. And if we're going up, it's where inner opposition ends. The male god is not depicted here because he represents the fully realized subtle body. In the center here, we have the symbol for Om, and it sits on top of the lingam of Shiva. And this is the pure, luminous lingam in its white state, which indicates that now the god is fully awake, fully aroused, in a blissful condition of consciousness that is completely at peace. It says in one of the sutras, the Kundalini Sutras, here he shines like a chain of lightning flashes. So here the individual is also fully awake and experiences union with Shiva, yet there is still an I that experiences the union. The beautiful Hakini sits on the fully illuminated lotus, again with all of these instruments, the mula beads, prayer, the book, scriptures. I think over there it's a kind of like a shaker to make a ritual sound. Here we have the Blessed Quaternity, the Holy Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, with the ascended Mary. Why would I put her here? Because this is really one of the primary goals of alchemy and of Kundalini. It's the raising of the feminine from its, you know, Shakti is down in the first chakra, she is in exile from Shiva. They are torn asunder. So she has to be brought back up. All of this is about raising the feminine back up to a union with the divine. You know, my very first dream and my first analysis was that there was a woman walking up a hillside leading these little children into a temple, and I followed her. It was a Jewish temple, which was interesting for me because of my Jewish background. But I thought of that image of the woman ascending up into the temple. It's the same theme. And in alchemy, what we're doing is we're finding the divine in matter. So matter is no longer considered evil, as it was in Christianity, but it's considered to be the vessel of the divine. And so as we become more aware of matter in our body as the vessel of the divine, we can say we are raising the feminine up to meet her Lord. Here's another image of that in alchemy, where we see the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit and Mary above, and below we see the mercurius monster being pulled out of a stone. That mercurius monster is like the kundalini. Mercurius, by the way, is masculine and feminine, not just masculine. So this is the monster pulled out of the stone is very similar to the snake coming up out of the first chakra. Here we have the beautiful image of the seventh chakra, the Sahasrara, thousand-petaled, and the alphabet now. There is a letter on each one of those petals. The Sanskrit alphabet is repeated, I think it's 26 times. So this is an image of what we might call the multiplicatio. We see the psyche everywhere. There's nothing that is not psyche. In one of the sutras, it says, the yogi who has after practice learned this excellent method is never born again in this world. For him, there is no dissolution, even at the time of final dissolution. And then I want to quote the Tao Te Ching, because it's relevant here. Those who speak do not know. Those who know do not speak. Close your mouth. Block off your senses. Blunt your sharpness. Untie your knots. Soften your glare. Settle your dust. This is the primal identity. There is an actual practice for the yogi where you shut off all the openings of the body, all of the openings in deep meditation. It's almost like the induction of death, but it induces that final awareness into the condition of the seventh chakra. It's said that when you reach the seventh chakra, the yogi places his foot on the guru's head and enters nirvana. In other words, the guru becomes something that propels you into nirvana, but you leave the guru. There is no longer anyone outside that has any wisdom or authority that you rely on. This could be called the killing of the Buddha. You remember that? What was that line? If you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. Yeah. At the very center of this lotus, right up here, there is a mandala, which is said to be the moon. This lotus is inverted, and the nectar that from this lotus drops down into the sixth in the lower chakras, and that's what ignites the bees early on. The sutra says, within it, Sahasrara, is the full moon without the mark of the hair. Without the mark of the hair. Resplendent as in a clear sky, it sheds its rays in profusion and is moist and cool like nectar. Inside it, constantly shining like lightning, is the triangle. And inside this, again, shines the great void that is served in secret by all the gods. This is the last picture of the ox herding pictures. Do you know the ox herding pictures? Ox herding pictures are a marvelous series in Zen Buddhism. And they're really beautiful. And it starts out that the man is looking for the ox. And then he sees the trail of the ox, the traces. And then he sees the ox and it's all black. And then he catches the ox and you see that the ox's tail is white. And then he rides the ox and eventually the ox becomes all white. And then you have a picture and it says, the ox and the man are one. And then the next picture is the solitary moon. Just the moon. That's the seventh chakra. And then, peculiarly at the end, you have a picture of the man, no ox, and it's called entering the city. So I want to use that image just to sum up a little bit, and I'm going to read this to you. Joseph Campbell tells us that there are essentially two opposing religious attitudes in the world. One attitude rejects the world and rejects life. It sees this world as an illusion at best and evil at worst. The best that one can do is live the life of a renunciant, perceiving the things of this world as drawing us into ignorance and unconsciousness. In this philosophy, the goal is to exit the world. The ultimate liberation is the great vision of unification that is experienced by the yogi who has achieved the highest level of consciousness and now leaves the body. The opposing attitude is to embrace life. In the West, one of the most colorful personifications of this attitude is Zorba, in Nikos Kazantzakis' novel, Zorba the Greek, which very interestingly is a novel about an inner conflict between the via negativa, which would be the way of renunciation, and the via positiva, which is the way of embracing the world of Zorba. You know, Zorba says the greatest sin a man can commit is to refuse a woman who invites him into her bed. That's the embracing of the world. For him, every drop of life is to be savored. He dances when he is joyous. He mourns to the fullest every loss. By fully embracing life's experiences, he does not attach to them, but rather moves through them. And then he can move on to the next adventure that even the most subtle experience can be. Tantric practice embraces a similar philosophy. Here we embrace the erotic and also many things that are forbidden in Hindu society. It is through the embrace that we are liberated. And this is at the heart of Jung's psychological attitude. We move through it, not around it or away from it. In speaking of neurosis, Jung says, I advise all people who have a neurosis, go into it now, live it, and then you have it in your hands, and it has not got you any longer. From this perspective, it is through the conscious and continuous engagement with the psyche that we free the ego from possession. So one difference in the process of becoming enlightened or individuated is over approaching a problem through detachment or through engagement. The second difference is over disengaging with life once enlightenment has been achieved, or on the other hand, re-entering life in a new way with a new consciousness. For some, like the Buddha, life is temporarily embraced until all beings are liberated. As previously discussed, it is said that upon enlightenment, the Buddha entered the ninth chakra and then went down to the fourth. This is where the two worlds of spirit and matter meet. In the ox herding pictures, enlightenment does not end with the vision of the solitary moon, the unity of all, or even with the experience of returning to the source. The final picture is called Entering the City with Bliss-Bestowing Hands. And one of the commentaries says the following: His humble cottage door is closed, and the wisest know him not. No glimpses of his inner life are to be caught, for he goes on his own way without following the steps of the ancient sages. Carrying a gourd, he goes out into the marketplace. Leaning against a stick, he comes home. He is found in the company of drunks and butchers. He and they are all converted into Buddhas. I understand his humble cottage door is closed to mean that he may be in the world, but not of the world. He is in a condition of introversion, which activates the inner world. He has no interest in notoriety, but only in living a humble life. He has found the self within himself, and therefore projections of the self are withdrawn from wisdom figures. He has met the Buddha and killed him. He follows only the inner voice. He has become so small that he is barely noticed. However, even the most debased of humans are transformed by encountering him. Another verse associated with this picture gives us further insight. Bare-chested and barefooted, he comes out into the marketplace. Daubed with mud and ashes, how broadly he smiles. There is no need for the miraculous power of the gods, for he touches, and lo, the dead trees come into full bloom. The last two stanzas depict a condition of complete self-containment on a psychological level. The living experience of the self means that the miraculous power is no longer outside oneself. Instead, one is within the psyche, and the psyche is within. This is akin to what the Chinese call being one with the Tao. When he says, the dead trees come into full bloom, it means one has achieved a natural unity. Therefore, the inner and the outer are synchronized. We would call this an experience of the unus mundus. Wilhelm Hauer explains that in contrast to those yogis who most value the exit from the world, the ox herding pictures describe a situation where the enlightened one allows the experience to drop back down into the unconscious. As my first analyst, James Kirsch, once said to me, at some point you need to make a conscious decision to live unconsciously. Just live. This embracing of all that life has to offer is the essential attitude which runs like a current throughout all of Jung's writings. It is ultimately experiential, ecstatic, Dionysian in nature, and a wisdom that begins in the heart. Near the close of his memoirs, he writes, "The Indian wishes to free himself from nature. In keeping with this aim, he seeks in meditation the condition of imagelessness and emptiness." I would modify that and say that's one strain of Indian thought. "I, on the other hand, wish to persist in the state of lively contemplation of nature and of the psychic images. I want to be freed neither from human beings nor from myself, nor from nature, for these all appear to me the greatest of miracles. Nature, the psyche, and life appear to me like divinity unfolded. And what more could I wish for?" So here we are left. Where we are left is with the idea that wholeness is a constant practice, and that the decisive defeat of the ego and the consequent victory for the whole person is in giving up the endeavor to achieve an ultimate goal. So that's all I have time for. I just want to say a little bit about tomorrow.
Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.